This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Let's just touch base then with everybody's favourite movie correspondent. He is Dr. Mark Kermode, and he's somewhere in Los Angeles. Whereabouts are you specifically, good doctor?
I'm in downtown. I'm in the bit in downtown, which when you look out in the middle of the night, it looks like the set of Blade Runner, because in fact, bits of it are the set of Blade Runner. In fact, yesterday I did that exciting thing of taking my kids to all these old buildings and going, look, that's the Bradbury building from Blade Runner. Look, that's the Sixth Street Tunnel from Blade Runner. And they were going, yeah, Dad, we haven't watched Blade Runner.
Yeah. What a great parental piece of advice that was.
Yes.
Now, tell us, just explain what's happening in terms of reviews that we can enjoy between now and 1 o'clock.
Well, there's just a superfluity of. There's The Bounty Hunter, which is the new Jennifer Aniston, Gerard Butler movie, the poster for which features some leaning and smiling in a way which is not perhaps initially promising. Scouting for Boys, new film by Thomas Turgoose. Spy Next Door with Jackie Chan, always a favourite. My Last Five Girlfriends, Dirty Oil, Happy Ever Afters. The thing we don't have, because I'm over on the other side of the world and it hasn't opened here yet and won't for a couple of weeks, is a review of I Love You, Philip Morris. So if anyone has seen I Love You, Philip Morris, which is being posted all over the place in the UK...
It's a bad poster as well. Bad poster.
A bad poster. But no, but don't... That doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad film, Simon. You shouldn't prejudge, although I know you're given to doing so.
Well, I think if you see a bad poster, you do... There's an element of prejudgment.
Yes, but you shouldn't, because a bad poster doesn't necessarily... I mean, I'll give you an example. The poster for The Dream of the Mad Monkey starring Jeff Goldblum was a terrible poster. In fact, in America, it was retitled as a Twisted Obsession with an even worse poster, but it's still a brilliant movie.
OK, so if you have seen I Love You, Philip Morris, you can send us an email, mayo@bbc.co.uk, and it may be that your review takes centre stage.
Supersedes, Mark.
Supersedes? Well, it just takes over.
Supersedes is a better word.
You haven't got anything to put against it. So what we'll do is we'll bring you the box office top 10 as well. Mark in Los Angeles. I'm in the UK, because that's the way it always seems to turn out. In the words of Sam Burrows, listener via Twitter earlier, you are the radio equivalent of Miyazaki's Castle in the Sky, floating untethered around the schedules.
There is no higher praise.
Indeed, because of racing from Chilcot. That's why we are here. and this from Bab Tuma in Damascus. Dear Dave, really? D and Dozy, can I draw your attention to the start of last week's confusing programme when you were live, delayed, in the past? As I listen on a podcast in Syria, I couldn't care less. It all sounds great here. But walking around the streets of Damascus, listening on some very good headphones, I could hear a distinct drumming and tapping at the very start of the hour, prior to Paul Greengrass and Matt Damon. It's rather distracting, and I'm wondering if large, flappy hands were responsible. I had a headache after 2 minutes, whereas it normally takes 10 minutes of the programme. Could you please ask the doctor to stop drumming his fingers in anticipation? From Bab in Damascus.
Was I drumming my fingers?
You do that quite a lot.
Do I?
Yes.
Can I just say, incidentally, on the subject of what time is it confusion, thank you so much to everybody who joined us on Twitter yesterday to explain to us what time the programme is starting, when I was trying to have a conversation with you across the Atlantic saying, Simon, what time are we actually on air? Because racing from Chilcot and the change in American summertime hour system is confusing all of us. And thank you so much for everybody for pitching in and for not being in any way sarcastic about the fact that we didn't have a clue what time we were on air.
Mel Lambert, listening avidly in Burbank. Sorry to be such an anorak, but the doctor is slightly incorrect. Yes, Blade Runner was indeed shot at the landmark Bradley building, but other scenes were filmed in the 2nd Street, not 6th Street Tunnel. In fact, that tunnel has appeared in so many other motion pictures and TV commercials that we locals refer to it as the Pickle of Los Angeles and a required location for any LA-based production.
The terrible thing is that even as I said 6th Street, knowing it was 2nd Street, because of course I filmed there when we shot on the edge of Blade Runner, I drove through that tunnel about 20 times with a camera rig mounted to the front of the car, having to do this apparently coherent link about how this is the tunnel through which Deckard drives on his way home to the building, which is nowhere near to it. And so even as I said 6th Street, I knew that I'd be corrected. And thank you very much once again for our listeners for proving the high calibre of fact-checking which is going on out there.
I love the early morning sound to your voice.
And it's the Bradbury building, not the Bradley building.
I'm just reading the email from Mel Lambert, who is in Burbank. Anyway.
Oh, did he write Bradley building?
Yes.
Right, in that case, it's the Bradbury Building. One all.
Finally, John in Huntingdon, or possibly John Huntingdon. Never have I anticipated an event more. The impending release today of The Bounty Hunter, starring two of our Friday favourites in Miss Aniston and Mr. Butler, has created an excitement in our household unknown since the great Millennium celebrations. To have a film with one of these stars would be a joy indeed, but to have both together seems a bounty beyond our greatest dreams. I do hope the good doctor will soon be casting his eye over the film. However, could you please give me good notice when he does so, as I would like to be fully prepared and seated in my favourite armchair with a mug of coffee and a plate full of custard creams, all the better to fully anticipate the good doctor's no doubt pithy and incisive comments on this latest offering from two of modern cinema's brightest stars. So, anyway, we'll get to that after 12:30.
I think
that's a fair bet.
I just say, one of the weird things is, I have read in the papers so many times recently about how much I hate blockbusters. It's just not true that I don't like blockbusters. On the other hand, well, let's get to the review.
Well, here comes the box office top 10. First of all, as you know, we always do the box office top 10 before we get to any reviews, Mark.
I was just setting you. I was teasing the audience with anti. They're not obviously that teased, but
we'll be getting there after the 12:30 news and sport. Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Lightning Thief, and The Cauldron of Penguins. There at number 10.
Well, demonstration of the fact that we said, well, look, it ain't no Harry Potter. And just look at its very swift exit from the top 10. That's the demonstration.
No, it's still in the top 10.
Therefore, that's
an exit, fine, does it?
If it's at number 10, you used to listen to Kid Jensen doing the charts, right? If something is on the way down at number 10, Simon, that means it's not going to be in the chart next week. In fact, shall we make a bet now that it's not going to be in the chart next week? And shall we do an accumulator on it, since that seems to work out so well for us?
My guess, it might still be in. I'll bet you a
fiver. Okay, fine. I make you a gentleman's bet. How much? What did you say? How much for sport relief?
I don't know. How much do you think?
100 quid.
Well, that's a little bit excessive. I'm just going to give 100 quid to sport relief anyway. Regardless of what happens.
Okay, so we'll do that regardless of what happens.
Okay. Right. The Princess and the Frogs at 9.
That was a costly
top 10 already, isn't it?
It was. Demonstrates that it isn't just a 3D CG, what I'm not allowed to refer to as Digimation, because every time I do, I get a load of very, very cross Twitters from people saying, it's not Digimation, it's digital animation, it's just animation. But it's, you know, I really love the Princess and the Frog.
The Crazies at number 8.
Much better than we had any right to expect. I mean, clearly not the political parable that the original was. It has a different form of nihilism. It's a much more modern form of nihilism in that it's slightly emptier and slightly bigger and everything goes kaboom, and it does have a quite blinding ending. I mean, it isn't a classic, and in a couple of years' time it'll be gone, but I did enjoy it whilst I was watching it, and it will play well. It is clearly playing well to the horror crowd. I don't think it's a breakout thing, but the Bat Pack will like it.
Lovely Bones at 7.
Well, you know, heaven is a place where nothing ever happens except for the fact that it looks like Super Mario Galaxy. I mean,
I thought heaven was a place on Earth.
Is it? And who's saying that?
It's Belinda Carlisle, I believe.
Oh, yeah, no, I was thinking of the Talking Heads. And you see, in a way, that's so much the difference between you and me. I think Talking Heads, you think Belinda Carlisle. Circle in the sand, that'll be you then. Essentially, I think it's an honourable failure, but it does demonstrate that that's an unfilmable book if what you attempt to do is to put heaven or the afterlife on screen. And look at all the other movies that have managed to do that better. The answer to the afterlife is not CGI. It's not doing Vincent Ward, What Dreams May Come, strange digital paintings. That just doesn't work.
If you wanted to rattle through these, that would be fine, as we've got a lot to do. Girl with a Dragon Tattoo at 6.
I like it very much. It's pretty long, and it is like there's loads and loads of different genres fighting for precedence in it. As I said last week, and I want to say again, just be warned, it is a tougher film than perhaps some reviews have led you to think, particularly if scenes of brutal sexual violence you find hard to watch. Now, I should say the scenes are meant to be hard to watch, but for me, they went right up to the line and perhaps even slightly over the line of what I needed to be told about the brutal violence.
If you want to rattle through these reviews, that'll be good.
I'll give you
a lot of time. Hatchie, A Dog's Tale at 5.
Richard Gere, everyone keeps saying to me it's a plot spoiler. Everyone said to me, I gave away the plot last week. I didn't give away the plot last week. Jason Isaacs kept trying to tell me that I'd given away the plot last week. I didn't give away the plot about what happened. But I have to say, it's a film about a dog who became famous for waiting at a train station after his master was no longer able to get off the train. Now, that's the setup. That's not a plot spoiler. That's the premise.
Why couldn't he get off the train? What had happened
because
to him?
Because he's in Super Mario CGI land.
Avatars at 4, enough said. Green Zone at 3. I want to read you this from Boothroyd and Friends. Dear Shaku and Maku, which is colloquial Iraqi youth greeting, in case we were wondering which we were. As someone who has worked in Iraq for nearly 3 years, I have not had the chance to visit the cinema much, although even I saw an Education before The Good Doctor. However, during one of my recent infrequent short breaks back to the UK, I jumped at the chance to see Green Zone. After a strong dislike of The Hurt Locker and Body of Lies, I feared I might struggle to enjoy anything set in Iraq. Countering this, I hoped that my love of all things Greengrass would continue for his latest offering. Not wanting to be the only one sitting in the cinema thinking, that is clearly the wrong shape of water bottle for the CIA, I gathered a few of my colleagues and we furtively headed to our local multiplex. Yes, the Iraqi accents are not perfect, the military's reluctance to wear helmets an interesting tactic, and many of the Americans needed a shave. Having said that, none of us have seen anything that captures so many aspects of life in post-Saddam Iraq so well.
Wow.
Some scenes were literally jaw-dropping in their visual authenticity, particularly those taking place at Baghdad Airport and inside the palaces. The dust, the sunlight, and the chaotic hustle and bustle of Baghdad were all captured perfectly for the first time. Once again, Paul Greengrass has shown everyone, including Catherine Bigelow, how it should be done. That is all who, and indeed ha, says Boothroyd and Friends. So, how about that?
He doesn't mention Jason's moustache, though, which I think was also terribly realistic.
He doesn't. A sad oversight from Boothroyd and Friends. Shutter Island's at two.
Somebody tweeted that if I thought Shutter Island was a better movie than The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, I was losing it. Well, sorry, I have therefore completely lost it. I do think Shutter Island is a good, fun movie. I don't think it's better than Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, but I think it's a much better Martin Scorsese movie, again, than people are giving it credit for, because I think of all his genre pastiches, it's the one that works. And you compare it to Cape Fear, which is a poor movie, this is a much, much better movie, and I enjoyed myself.
Alice in Wonderland's at number one.
I went to Universal Studios yesterday, and two of the rides are sitting there and watching 3D films. One of them's Terminator 2 3D, specially made for it by James Cameron. One of them is Shrek 4D, which is 3D, but with your chairs shake and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, this is it, right? This is absolutely the demonstration that 3D is a fairground attraction. Sitting in a fairground ride place for 20 minutes in a big auditorium with actual smoke and actual bum-shaking seats and all that sort of stuff, 3D is perfectly fine. In the cinema, it has no role. And as you can see when you look at Alice in Wonderland, it is a film which is retrofitted, to use a Blade Runner term, retrofitted into 3D, and is just clearly never meant to be a 3D film. Doesn't need it, doesn't want it. For some of the film, doesn't actually have it. If you want to go and see Alice in Wonderland, which I think is a weaker...
Okay,
still
enough time there. So a couple of emails here from... just sum up the listener reaction to Alice, and then we'll bring you news and then sport, and then we'll do some reviews up to 1 o'clock. First of all, Joe Berwick in Den Haag in the Netherlands. Having just seen Alice in Wonderland, I have to say that you, Dr. K, were too kind on the wishy-washy, boring, predictable nonsense that the story is. It's completely dull, and I felt every single minute of the 2 and a bit hours. Gavin in London... having caught Tim Burton's Alice in 3D last weekend, I agree with what the doctor quothed. In contrast, Avatar, where every single shot was subtly crafted to make use of the virtual extra dimension, Alice felt like the 2D conversion job that it was. The film itself was pleasant enough, Johnny Depp being the predictable highlight, and the director delivering his trademark spindly postscape. However, I wonder if Plug A and Socket B would agree that perhaps it's time for Burton to tackle something outside his traditional comfort zone. I'm a fan of his gothic sensibility, but one could argue he's been making the same film since 1989.
With the exception of Big Fish, which I think is the exception, and of course is the one of his films that didn't do very well, and of course Ed Wood, which is just an extraordinary piece of work and still, I think, his best movie.
Let's get stuck into a movie which I know you've been looking forward to for a very, very long time. The posters make it look very exciting. The cast is terrific. The whole idea of the story, I'm intrigued by. Take it away.
But before that, let's do The Bounty Hunter, right?
Okay, so
the best way of describing this is, imagine, if you will, Midnight Run being remade, but in the role of Robert De Niro, Gerard Butler, and in the role of Charles Grodin, Jennifer Aniston. Because that's essentially what this is. The story is, there's this couple, right? They used to be married, but they're not married anymore. She is now a hot reporter. And when I say hot reporter, I don't mean hot reporter in the Jennifer Aniston is hot sense. I mean she's a hot reporter. She's on the trail of some hot...
She's just hot?
No, she's a hot reporter, as opposed to she's a hot and then a reporter.
You mean she is sought after? She's very good at what she does. Is that
It's the reporting that she does that has the hotness, not the Jennifer Aniston-ness.
And not her clippity-clop high heels.
No. Although she does clip and indeed clop, and she has one of those movie jobs that she's a journalist. She comes into an office and she shows no sign of ever having worked there. This is like the Meg Ryan is a fighter pilot thing, you know. So I don't believe for 1 minute that Jennifer Aniston is a hot reporter. But anyway, she has a parking offence. She's meant to go to court. She doesn't go to court because she's so hot on the trail of a story that she needs to go and follow this lead. So she skips court to go and do this. And then, because she skipped bail, a bounty hunter is set out. And oh, the hilarity. The bounty hunter that is set out to catch her is her former husband. So he is given the job of arresting and retrieving his ex-wife and bringing her back to jail. So, and then the deal is they'll have to spend time together, probably handcuffed together at some point, and they hate each other. Or do they? Here's a clip.
Fancy meeting you here.
Yeah. Fancy.
You look great. As beautiful as the day we first met.
I don't know what you're up to, but I'm working.
Oh, working? Me too. And what I do is I hunt down criminals. Idiots who jump bail, specifically.
You are a bounty hunter?
Yep. As much as it pains me to say this, and it really does, I gotta take you to jail. You want to make a break for it? I will give you a 10-second head start for old time's sake.
I am an adult, Milo.
10. Nine.
Do you really think that I would...
8. 7.
Is that her running off there?
That is her running off going clippity-cloppity. And can you tell the difference between that and the horses? Listen, this is what Gerard says about the project. I can't do... Shall I do it in the voice of Gerard in Sparta?
No.
I will do it anyway. I took one look at this script and I loved it. It was sharp, hilarious and edgy, and it was, and I was on. I laughed from start to finish and I thought, I want to play that guy. And so then, right, this is a quote about how the film was directed. It said, through the bickering and the fighting, they have to start falling in love as well. And the director did a really good job executing that. Well, if by did a really good job executing that, you mean did a really good job killing that idea totally stone dead, then yes. Here are the problems. Firstly, the biggest problem in this film is not Jennifer Aniston. Jennifer Aniston may have the televisual face to die for, and every time I see her, I scream, why aren't you on television? But here, what she... And I don't believe she's a reporter, and she doesn't do anything funny at any point, or cute, or in any way interesting, but she's not the really big problem. The really big problem is that Gerard Butler is staggeringly out of his depth in a way which is really quite surprising, because essentially... All he's being, you know, asked to do is to run around being gruff and you know, occasionally look happy about the fact that he's hoiking Jennifer Aniston over his shoulder and then locking her in the trunk of a car and then driving off. But he looks like he doesn't really know how to do that. I mean, you keep thinking, fine, every now and then he takes his shirt off and he does the Sparta thing, and the toplessness in the film is entirely Gerard Butler. But he has no comedy value or timing, or it's like comedy is a foreign language. It's like watching somebody go, this comedy thing, how does that work? Because I read the script and I laughed. But how does it work when you get it on screen? If you go to the BBFC's description of the film, which is once again is brilliant, right? It talks about the fact the reason it's got the certificate it's got is because it includes infrequent sex references. It's got a scene set inside a pole dancing club in which they point out, but all the dancers are wearing some form of clothing, mainly thongs, which, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't count as some form of clothing. But then it says all
what is
issues
it, what does it count of then? What does it count as?
What do you think? Somebody's wearing a thong, they're clothed?
No, but it counts as clothing, doesn't it? If you're wearing a thong, that's clothes. What else would it be?
All right, on a technical level, you're perhaps correct that a thong is technically clothing, Simon. And I would invite you to demonstrate that fact by coming in next week correctly dressed for the show wearing a thong.
I always wear my Five Live thong every week.
I really wish you hadn't put that image in my head. Anyway, at the end of the BBFC's report, it says, and I quote, all issues in the film are set in a comedy context. And that is it. Once again, the BBFC have brilliantly reviewed the film. Actually, the whole film is set in a comedy context. They didn't say the issues in the film are allowable because they're funny. They didn't, because sometimes what they say is, well, this happened, but it was, you know, it was funny, or this happened, but it was done in a way. But they say is, it's set in a comedy context. And what you have here is exactly that, a film which is set in a comedy context, but isn't ever at any point actually funny. And if you think of Midnight Run, which of course is the film this is trying so hard to be and failing so miserably, you think of all the ways that Charles Grodin prevents Robert De Niro from getting him to where he needs to get him. And things like the scene when Robert De Niro wants to get him on a plane and Charles Grodin suddenly has that panic attack. These things go down, these things go down. And it's every time they end up in a worse situation, it's brilliantly sort of... In this, it's just like the plot. What are we going to do now? Oh, I don't know. I know. Let's get them to have to stop in the Love Shack motel where they spent their honeymoon. Okay, fine. Let's do that. How should we do it? I know. The car will catch fire. Somebody will shoot at them. They'll break down. I don't... Just, it doesn't matter. Just do it. And do you think there's any possibility that when they're in that place, one of them will handcuff the other one to the bed for comedy purposes and the maid will... I'm sure that will happen. Just go... So the whole thing is a comedy context. From a script that made Gerard Butler laugh out loud, which Jennifer Aniston presumably did on the basis that it would somehow broaden her repertoire, which it hasn't, and which has no, nil, nil, nada, nothing, niente, nil point laughter whatsoever. Total straight-face experience and proof positive that what Gerard Butler needs to do when he's in a film is to take his shirt off, put on a loincloth, hold a shield and go, "This is Sparta!"
Is it worse than Leap Year?
Actually, it is. And the reason it's worse than Leapy Ear is that Leapy Ear was just terrible from beginning to end. But this was actually disappointing because I thought that Gerard Butler would be quite funny because having seen him in that previous film in which he did "If You Don't Do This Now, I'm Going to Do the Next Thing, What's That? I'm Going to Kill Everyone." In which, I mean, in all his serious films, I've always thought he was funny. This is the funny film and he's clearly not got a comic bone in his body.
Eber Dawson, IBA, would that be Eber or Iber? Anyway, says, "I would like to share with you a review from the New York Times. Really, it is just the last line of the review, which tells you why the film is rated as such, which pretty much says all you'll ever need to know about why this film exists, okay? It says, 'The Bounty Hunter is rated PG-13, parents strongly cautioned, witless sexual innuendo and witless violence.'" That's the review from the New York Times. How does that work?
That's right, you get away with it if it's witless. Very good. But I think, yeah, that and comedy... You don't need film critics anymore. The censors are doing the reviewing for us.
Mark's in Los Angeles. We've kind of done Jennifer Aniston, we've kind of done Gerard Butler. What else is taking our fancy, Mark?
Well, since I understand that time is tight, can we talk about Scouting for Boys, which I really like? Scouting for Boys is this very strange...
The Scouting book for boys.
Scouting book for boys, yeah. Yes. Why did I say Scouting for Boys? Because that's the name of a song. Which plays like one of those dark American ballads like Knoxville Girl. And it stars Thomas Turgoose, who was really great in This Is England and Summer's Town, the films by Shane Meadows, who Shane Meadows kind of discovered and clearly nurtured. And he's turning into a really fine actor. It often happens that people who have sort of hit movies very early on in their careers find it very hard to develop from that. But he is a real exception. Anyway, the story is he's on a caravan park and he's... only real joy in life is this girl with whom he's a friend, who he's been friends with for ages and ages. They kind of finish each other's sentences. Her parents are divorced. Her father gets custody. It turns out she's going to have to move away, but she doesn't want to move away and he doesn't want her to move away. And then either she runs away or she disappears or she's abducted and maybe he knows where she is and maybe he doesn't. And all that we know is that they have that kind of relationship in which everything that they said made sense to them and only them. Here's a clip.
The secret will be to think like them.
What, think like sheep?
Sheep dogs think like sheep. That's basically their secret.
Sheep dogs think like sheep dogs.
You ought to think like a sheep dog. You think like a sheep dog. But me, I'm going to think like a sheep. You're looking at me like a sheep dog now. You can stop that for a start.
No, I just... You ready?
To be a sheep. You bet.
3, 2, 1.
Go! Go that way! Get that one! That one again! Get down! Get down!
So here's the thing about the film. The thing that it gets right is, it has an incredible sense of the lives and imaginations of its young characters, who it never seems to patronise, who it seems to be right inside their heads. It has that sense of genuine heartbreak that even some very light-hearted fare like Gregory's Girl has. It sometimes reminded me of the films of David Gordon Green. It's got a really lyrical visual quality. It's shot by the same person who shot Fish Tank and has that sense of being right inside its character's world. Occasionally, it reminded me of things like, well, even Waterland, I suppose. I mean, it has this, you know, this strange Norfolk setting, which is rural, has sometimes a kind of Badlands feel to it. You have the sense that something very bad may happen, but you also have the sense that nothing at all may happen. And in fact, there are occasionally moments in which key developments are almost, you almost think they're dreamlike. When the Thomas Turgoo's character first is confronting the disappearance of the girl, but he knows where she is, or does he really know where she is, or is he imagining that he knows where she is? Is that just a fantasy? And the whole thing plays out in a fairly sort of extraordinary way. Towards the end of it, it falls into some plot developments that I think some people will find hard to swallow. Although, as I said, I think the underpinning of it is, if you think about those classic dark American ballads, and again, I think Knoxville Girl, there is a connection there. It sort of makes poetic sense. But the really impressive thing about it was not only that it was a sort of flimsy story, well told and given a significance that occasionally the music fought against, but that Thomas Turgoo is turning into such an adept performer, and I was really genuinely impressed. And clearly, the director here is bringing out in him even more than Shane Meadows found in him. I'm not sure how wide the release for Scouting Book for Boys is, but you know, do go and see it if you get a chance. It really is quite remarkable.
Let's have a word on I Love You, Philip Morris. Now, explain why you haven't seen this again, in case people were
because it's
not
opening
the show,
not opening here for a while. It's opening there first, because I think actually it is a French produced movie. So I was away when they had the national press show. So tell us what it's like.
Okay. So a couple of emails. First of all, Henry in Bournemouth went to see a preview of I Love You, Philip Morris on Wednesday. Very much enjoyed it. The opening 15 minutes, it appeared to be struggling to know what kind of film it wanted to be, veering from an almost screwball comedy to a tongue-in-cheek style. After this, though, it settled into an easygoing and enjoyable rhythm. Jim Carrey is very good as Stephen Roberts, the con man who falls for Ewan McGregor in jail, who incidentally plays his role as Philip Morris very well. The film is very tongue-in-cheek, riffing all sorts of gay stereotypes for laughs, and it more than manages the five laughs needed to be a half-decent film. He says, P.S., look out for the Orange Wednesday Man, as he's known to UK audiences. He actually does other stuff, most notably this film. He was in John Adams, but every time he comes up, everybody in the cinema always laughs. Stephen Coventry, I saw I Love You, Philip Morris yesterday after having read some glowing reviews. I was hugely disappointed. Jim Carrey veered uneasily between Ace Ventura, Gurning, and Man on the Moon's subtlety. Ewan McGregor's on autopilot, and it just wasn't as blackly comic nor as funny as I'd been led to believe. The central gay relationship is difficult to buy into, considering the two lead stars' personas, and I spent the entire first half feeling uneasy as to whether or not this was childishly exploiting the exotic factor of the main character's homosexuality. The tone is wildly uneven in the worst way, and a second half revelation, which may have, which many have said is subversive and totally surprising, I thought was unbelievably obvious. A big disappointment. Someone who sent us an email, but he had his phone number on it, so we gave him a ring. This is what he thinks. It's Mark in Middlesbrough. Hello, Mark.
Hi, I just want to say I completely disagree with our last email. There's the bit in the middle, I thought that was really good. It's a really good marriage of comedy and drama, and that scene really proves it. And I think it's a really good performance by Jim Carrey as well. It doesn't feel uneven. It feels like a good marriage of his comedic work, stuff like Liar Liar, and his dramatic work like The Truman Show. You know, you've got Ewan McGregor finally stopped faffing about with George Lucas and Dan Brown, getting his career back on track. And I thought it was very good.
So Jim Carrey's playing Stephen Roberts. Just explain who he is, Mark.
He's like a family man. He's like a very Christian family man, all this kind of thing. And he's in a car accident. And he says he's been gay for as long as he can remember, but it's only after this accident, this near-death experience, that he decides to come out, live a life of excess. But he suddenly realises, you know, as he says, being gay is very expensive. So, you know, he becomes a con man. Ends up in prison, where he meets Ewan McGregor's Philip Morris, falls in love, and there's difficulties with their relationship.
Are those seagulls flying over your head, Mark, in Middlesbrough?
Say again, sorry?
Are those seagulls with you, or are they in Los Angeles?
They're not in Los Angeles.
I'm at university, so I ran out quickly.
All right, OK. Mark, appreciate that. Does Mark in Los Angeles want to ask Mark in Middlesbrough a question? Has Mark in Middlesbrough seen it and Mark in Los Angeles hasn't?
Well, I am now looking forward to it, since we've now had completely conflicting reviews. So my verdict next week. But, you know, I'm impressed by anybody who can review while seagulls are flying overhead. Can I very quickly do you 30 seconds on The Spy Next Door, the Jackie Chan movie?
First of all, let's just say, Mark in Middlesbrough, thanks very much indeed for the call. Mark in Los Angeles, yes, you're on now.
Spy Next Door, new Jackie Chan movie, right? Jackie Chan, very interesting, is essentially having been an action star who was known for the fact that he had this kind of rubbery body, that he could throw himself against walls and do incredible stunts and not basically not die because he did all his own stunts, has essentially reinvented himself as a kid's comedy hero. If you ever seen that kid's TV program, Heads, when they have this character, Jackie Chan, Jackie Chan, Jackie Chan, and it's like, Jackie Chan, Jackie Chan, make a cup of tea. And it's very, very funny, and kids love him. There are kids' comic strips that kids really, really love. And ever since, I mean, I really liked that film Around the World in 80 Days, which nobody else apart from me liked. And the story with Jackie Chan in Spy Next Door is, Jackie Chan is an international super spy, but obviously he's pretending not to be, and he's having a relationship with the woman next door that he wants to take on to the next level, but she doesn't know that she's a super spy. She thinks he's the most boring man on earth, and the problem is that his kids think he's the most boring man on earth, and in order to win her heart, he has to win over the kids, and the only way he can do that is by basically them finding out that he is an international super spy and not just the most boring man on earth. The funny thing with Jackie Chan is what they normally do, because Jackie Chan's command of the English language isn't great, is that they put him on screen with somebody, you know, who's like wisecracking and known for their wisecracking and known for the fact that they can speak really fast. So Jackie Chan does all the falling over and the pratfalls and the sort of silent comedy stuff. In this, one of the guys he's up against is Billy Ray Cyrus. And the funniest thing about The Spy Next Door is that Jackie Chan's command of the English language is far superior to that of Billy Ray Cyrus. I mean, I see that it hasn't been very well reviewed, but I kind of liked it partly because I just like Jackie Chan. And the outtakes aren't very funny at the end, but, you know, it's Jackie Chan. It's just impossible to take against anything with Jackie Chan, and even if it's as weak as The Spy Next Door.
And our movie of the week?
Scouting Book for Boys.
Will that get a general distribution? Will everybody be able to enjoy that, or just a few elite people?
No, but you know me, I'm just an elite art house bore who hates mainstream blockbusters.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.